Hello and welcome to the second episode of Jacobite Clans. We hope you enjoyed the previous episode, and over the next few weeks we'll be going into more detail around some of the key exhibition stories and characters of the latest Perth Museum and Art Gallery exhibition, Jacobite Clans. I'm back with Dr. Nikki Small this week, where we'll be sitting down to discuss the Battle of Killiecrankie and the impact it had on Perthshire and how it affected the local people. Nikki.
Well, Killiecrankie is one of the reasons we're doing this whole exhibition, because of course it's the 330th anniversary. Bonnie Dundee's an amazing character, so we look a wee bit at him and his life in the exhibition. The Battle of Killiecrankie was very short and sharp. It was a Highland charge which had a devastating effect on the government forces within a very short time. But the big tragedy of the battle, and we go into more detail of the battle in the exhibition, but the big tragedy is of course that Dundee himself is killed. So some great stories around that. How was he killed? What was his injuries? Uh-huh. And what happens to him? That kind of thing. So we're looking at that.
All right.
I'm not going to give too much of that away. There's some interesting theories about what happened to Dundee.
So a bit of mystery already.
There is a mystery, absolutely. And then his body is actually at Blair Castle. You can go today, and visit the little chapel there that's on the hill, just in the castle grounds, and you'll see the grave of Bonnie Dundee. So this battle's very famous, and people have been marking that, and there's lots to visit when you go to Killiecrankie. It's a lovely area, beautiful Highland Perthshire. You can walk there, you can see all sorts of things. It's lovely. Blair Castle is a stronghold of the Murray of Atholl family, and Dundee came into Perthshire knowing that he might raise the men of Atholl. Now, the Murrays of Atholl, again, a big noble family, huge noble family in Perthshire. So what are they going to do in this situation? Because they have to decide one way or other. Are they joining Dundee and going with the Stuarts, or are they hanging in there with William and Mary? Are they going to say, no, we've chosen this Protestant king and queen? So the old Marquess of Atholl, the father of the family, he does what they do best, is that he decides that he will leave. He retires to Bath. To take the waters, he's unwell, and he absents himself at the time. So this is a good strategy, a noble strategy, and he does actually declare for William and Mary in Edinburgh, and he behaves quite honourably, but it takes him a wee bit of time, and there's a bit of worry whether he'll do this. And he leaves his son, John Murray, the young Lord Murray at the time that he is. He will later become the first Duke of Atholl, that son, and he's quite an important character.
Okay. Yeah.
So, and he will have a big family. Mm-hmm. But at that time, he's left handling what happens in Blair with Killiecrankie looming and Bonnie Dundee looking for men. Mm-hmm. So do the men of Atholl turn out for Bonnie Dundee? And there's a great family issue there, which again we'll explore in the exhibition. So this shows us how noble families have these tensions of personal belief. Maybe they want to be Jacobites, and noble family interest. What's best for the whole family here? Because you have to remember, this is like clans. You know, lots of people in the whole surrounding area rely on this noble family. A clan means family, children. Mm-hmm. And this is the kind of whole system that we're working with in Perthshire, where people have a homestead, they have their homes, their lives, their families are brought up, and they give allegiance to a lord, a clan chief.
Yeah.
And the clan chief, in response, to reciprocate, basically says, "Well, I will protect all of you, but when I need men, you fight for me." And this works for him because he can then go to his king, who he has allegiance to, and say, "I can raise this many men when you need me."
Yeah.
So this is really important. This is how the clans work.
Right.
And at Killiecrankie, we don't know individual names as such, but we do know the big clans that turned out at Killiecrankie, and who was there on that particular battle, and that's how they fought. And that's actually the tragedy as well, is that the clans fight from the front too, that the clan chiefs would lead a Highland charge. They would lead that. It's a terrifying battle. I don't know huge amounts about battle, but they fire off their guns and weapons, and then they throw them aside and start charging on the enemy. Mm. I mean, can you imagine that coming towards you?
Yeah.
It's great. I mean, you do get great film depictions of these things now, and it's amazing how this happens. But of course, it's a hugely dangerous way, because of course the clan chiefs lead from the front. They don't sit at the back, commanding affairs. They get right in there. So that's why they're often lost, and that's why clans can be decimated in battles as well, because they'll lose a huge number of good people if that's a point where there are great losses.
Yeah.
And this is you know, and this is why the clans are so they're tight. The curator at Castle Mingus told me that, and he's a military man himself, and he said, you know, that's why people, the Band of Brothers, you know, people who live together, who have their homes together, they are on the battlefield fighting with kin, and that really matters, and that's really important. So when they're all out together, you know, for the Jacobite cause, that you know, they hold together for that kind of reason. So it's, the clan is really... we don't always understand it, but you have to get into that mentality, I think, to see what's really important.
It's very much like a family aspect of it. Yeah.
So the difficulty is in families like Murray of Athol, where some people are maybe, for the good of the family, they decide that they're taking one course, whether it's Jacobite, whether it's not, and others in the family don't. And that's what's interesting to look at in the family trees and the family maps. Who doesn't? Now, the first Duke of Athol, this family, will stay loyal to the crown, William and Mary originally, but other people in the family will become Jacobites.
Ah, right, okay. Mm-hmm. So, what, like immediate family, brothers? Or?
Yeah, I mean, Lord George Murray, who is one of the well-known Jacobite military commanders, is a son of the first Duke of Athol.
Right.
So he... he goes over to the Jacobite cause, and he's a great, as I say, great military commander. So we look into his story as well, and just how could he do that within the family? How could that happen? And it's really, really interesting. The Duke of Athol has a sister-in-law, Margaret, Lady Nairn, and she and her husband, the Duke's brother William, are Jacobites.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see how they just manage these Jacobite alliances within the whole family. If you read, I've read all the women's letters in the family, that's my research. I was looking at how they all got along and then suddenly realised this woman's a Jacobite. She has completely different views and beliefs to everyone else in the family, but they all get along, they all write letters, they all worry over the children, they talk about family news, they all attend weddings and do things, but they have a different perspective.
Yeah.
So... Lady Nairn becomes quite a staunch Jacobite, really firmly Jacobite, and as I said to you in the last episode, you know, she goes on to create this big family dynasty, you know, marrying into other Jacobite families. So Lord George Murray is one Jacobite, but she is accused by the first Duke of Athol of seducing three of his sons to the Jacobite cause in 1715. He's furious with her at this point. She is the worst woman. And he calls her all sorts of names, having gotten on with her quite well, but this turning of his sons over. Now, I think they're young men, they're looking for adventure, there's all sorts of reasons why they would get involved. I think very early, one of the brothers of the first Duke, James, a brother, gets involved in the Battle of Killiecrankie, and his antics are put down to reckless, youthful japes, you know, and he gets off because he could have been executed. You know, that's what you're looking at here. You know, if your son is, or your brother or somebody gets involved, but the family were able to plead on his behalf and bring him home. But in the later 1715 rising, three more sons come out in favour of the Jacobites.
Right, okay. So at this point, you've got quite a lot...
Family politics. It's all difficult. But the other part of a noble family, and I've said this earlier as well, is what if the Jacobites had actually succeeded? What if the Stuarts had returned to the throne? So in some ways it's a bit of an insurance policy having a foot in both camps. Because if you're overturned, then you have family members who will be high on the Stuart King's list of people to honour for having been loyal for all those years. And that's really important as well.
And you'd be backing like two horses, like from two different teams, which, you know, is could argue is a sensible way to do things.
So that maybe explains why they all manage to get along, and you don't see them really falling out about these sort of differing aspects. And you have to remember this happens over decades as well. It's not always immediate, although there are real crisis points.
Sure.
The Battle of Killiecrankie is one, 1715 uprising in Sheriff Muir is another one, the 45 being but there are lots of other ones in between. And family in 1708, William Lord Nairn, he's the brother of the first Duke of Athol, he's arrested for Jacobite activity and taken to London. And this is bad news.
Definitely.
But Margaret, Lady Nairn, his wife, she goes all the way to London to get him off, and she speaks to, it's Queen Anne at that point, who will be the monarch, and she gets an audience with Queen Anne to get her husband out of the tower.
And kind of going back to, you know, Lady Nairn, you seldom hear about women at the kind of front of politics and stuff. Can you kind of elaborate on a bit of her?
Well, of course, women in that period, there's a tiny, tiny minority at the top of the social sphere who can make political decisions. People don't have, there's not a universal franchise, nobody has the vote, nobody, you know, all of these kinds of things. And that was what some of my research was about, looking at how involved were women in politics, and the answer is hugely involved. Lots of people are hugely involved, even if it's just a tiny minority who make those political decisions. Mm-hmm. And noble women particularly are well placed to influence and understand those things. So Lady Nairn is a very astute lady. She has all sorts of business, legal, financial knowledge, as she must. She runs a big estate, she looks after a noble household. And she understands the politics of all that period and that kind of knowledge that she has to have. And people have said that Jacobite women exploit the Jacobite cause to get really involved in these things, and there's a bit of truth in that they do come to the fore. They have to. They a lot of them have husbands who go into exile, and they when the husbands leave to go to France to live with the Stuart monarchs, sometimes it's the women that stay behind to run the estates and to claw back what they can. Sometimes it's put in their name so that the estates can't be forfeit. And they have to use really complex legal procedures to get that stability again. And women do this very well. My argument's always been that they don't do it out of nothing. You know, they must have had that knowledge in the first place.
Yeah, of course.
So it's just been kind of waiting to give them that opportunity to shine. You know, and the Jacobite crisis points are when women really shine. And lots of them are fiercely Jacobite. They have their own views. Mm-hmm. They don't go with what their husbands say. They spy for Jacobites. They give information to Jacobite people. Yeah, Lady Nairn spied for the Earl of Mar. She sent on information. They write letters and ciphers. So they have special symbols, and they know how to communicate with one another. There's a huge issue when you go to the archives at this point, because the letters that have been kept are hugely decimated because Jacobites. Of course, this was treasonable activity.
Sure, so a lot of information has been lost as well.
It's been lost, which is tragic, but you do see still some letters. And you love it when you come to that letter when it says burn after reading, and you realise that the person didn't burn it after reading.
Yeah.
But it's still there for us to see. And you can come across letters where there are strange symbols. You're thinking, what is she writing here? And of course, it's something that's been understood between her and her correspondent that she is... that she's writing about. And when Lady Nairn goes south to London in 1708, you know, she meets people all the way down. She reports on her journey, who she meets and where the troops are meeting, what the news is, what's the news from abroad, what are the French doing in this, what are the Spanish doing. You've got to remember, Jacobites have great allies, other countries.
Yeah.
You know, they're all really frightened of this. You know, the Spanish are coming, good grief, you know, when is this happening? The French are with them, you know, and this is really big stuff. And you have to think about how communications work. Letters and conversations. You know, news is difficult to get hold of. And can you trust it? Do you believe it? How old is the news? How long has this taken to get here? So all of these things. We live in a very modern age where everything's
very
instant. And in those days, you know, these things could be really upsetting. And Jacobites are... Mm-hmm. There's a lot of propaganda against them at some points too. Mm-hmm. So Lady Nairn, she finds her news. She sends this report home. She writes about this. And some of it is slightly coded, so
she's very, very switched on. She's not one that will let something go past her.
Definitely not. I'm a real fan, and then she has this big family, manages and marries all her daughters and family into other Jacobite families. So she's got a real eye on the bigger picture, which is quite amazing for women of that period. I'm a bit of a champion for women at that time.
Yeah.
So I'm really pleased that we've got her and other women, and of course Flora MacDonald feature as well. We'll probably talk
about that. I think we'll come back to Flora MacDonald in a future episode as well, because again, like the Bonnie Prince Charlie portrait, we do have a portrait of Flora MacDonald on loan from National Galleries, and there's a complimentary exhibition set up alongside Jacobite Clans Icons, which runs for the same time, 29th of June to the 19th of October, and again, free to visit at Perth Museum and Art Gallery. Cool, that's absolutely fascinating. I'm glad we kind of had this chat about Lady Nairn. Who she was such
a... Glad to know some more about her.
Yeah, definitely. I'm looking forward to kind of sitting down next week and finding out more about the Jacobites. Very much fascinating learning for myself. Hopefully everybody else that's listening as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much, Nicole. Cheers.